We have the opportunity to push back against what we think is an overreach of the Department of Justice. We don't necessarily embrace the fact that Washington, D.C. has all the answers. We want to be able to do it ourselves in ways that we think make sense for Alabama. And in fact, the governor's plan demonstrates that.
That's the Alabama Attorney General as we wrap up, Andrew Jarecki.
Yeah. I mean, that experience of talking to him was just remarkable because it's a kind of government speak that is devoid of the humanity of it, right? Whether he's visited the Alabama prisons or not, sort of irrelevant. He is the person that's running the justice system in that state, and he's obviously doesn't believe that there's a problem.
30 seconds. Solitary confinement. Who's in, who's out right now?
Melvin Ray has been released. Robert O'Counsel and Raul Poole are still in. And what I would just say is we made this film over 7 years, but the issue in Alabama's prison is still very urgent and very current. Since 2019, 1,500 people have died. And as you can see, they are threatened by voices that speak up. They are an authoritarian power that wants to quell dissent. That is what some of the people in our film are dealing with right now. And so I hope that people will watch, go to our website. There are ways to take action.
The website
is www.thealabamasolution.com.
Charlotte Kaufman and Andrew Jarecki, co-directors of the Oscar-nominated Alabama Solution. Attorney Tiffany Johnson Cole joining us from Alabama. Thank you so much for this incredible, epic work. I'm Amy Goodman.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, February 21st at 4 p.m. for a special Black History Month roundtable discussion on The Motif, Reimagined, a Jazz Sensibility. We welcome four amazing contributors to Portland and Multnomah County civic life in a discussion on public health, politics, and protest, featuring Dr. Gina Gulliam, Dr. James Mason, the Honorable Saran Kopp, and the Honorable Ron Herndon. That's a special Black History Month roundtable discussion during The Motif on Saturday, February 21st at 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Open Signal PDX, presenting their Youth Media Collective, a six-month collaborative for youth ages 14 to 18 to explore storytelling, journalism, and media production. A listening session will take place on February 18th at Open Signal. More info at opensignalpdx.org/calendar.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a possible ballot initiative to redirect Portland climate funds to hire more police gets a court hearing.
Portland City Council will rework its committee system.
And Oregon snowpack could get a boost, but it may be too late.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 16th, 2026. I'm Jar Salem.
And I'm Terrence Burns. A Multnomah County judge will rule next week on whether a local ballot initiative to move 25% of Portland's climate fund to hire more police is legal. The Portland Clean Energy Fund, or PCEF, was passed by voters in 2018. It put a 1% tax on giant retailers, and set that money aside for climate justice projects and job programs for the transition away from fossil fuels. It proved very successful, pulling in many millions more than originally expected. But a new initiative petition was put forward by the new owner of Big Pink, Jeff Swickard, and the Portland Police Association would take from that fund to hire more cops. It would redirect a quarter of all funds to hire at least 400 more officers. Climate advocates challenged the ballot measure in county court on Friday. They argue that it violates the single subject rule for ballot measures because it groups climate funding with police spending. They also highlight typos and oversights in the ballot language that they say could confuse voters. Judge Eric Dahlin seemed to be persuaded by attorneys on both sides. Dahlin said, quote, "It almost seems like we don't want police here, and we don't like this fund, and we're going to kill two birds with one stone." Later, though, he questioned if PSEF was really a dedicated fund, as the advocates challenged, since the City Council can and has reallocated its funds for other purposes. The fund has been used to fill in budget gaps at the city, but most of those projects have been at least tangentially related to climate justice. Last week, though, Portland Mayor Keith Wilson floated taking from the Climate Fund to pay for a renovation at the Moda Center in order to keep the Trailblazers in town. Judge Dahlin will issue this ruling on whether the ballot initiative can go forward to collect signatures on February 24th.
Portland City Council will consider overhauling its committee structure later this week. Currently, there are 8 council committees, and much of the first year of the new city council system was spent figuring out how they should work. In their presidential election last month, councilors talked about their frustrations with the committee structure. A few key themes emerged. There were too many committees. Their size was too small to allow for councilors to communicate without becoming a quorum. And it was murky how items that passed out of committee would be scheduled for the full council. Council President Jamie Dunphy highlighted overhauling the system and making it more fair as a key priority of his. A new proposal slims the committee list down to 5. The first, Public Works, would encompass much of the work of the current Transportation and Infrastructure Committee and the Climate and Land Use Committee. Housing and Permitting is the second committee, mostly carrying on the role of the current Housing and Homelessness Committee. City Life is the third new committee, absorbing the work of the current Arts and Economy Committee and the Labor and Workforce Development Committee. Then there's Community and Public Safety, keeping a similar scope as before. The final committee is Finance and Governance, fittingly a merging of the Finance and Governance Committees. Forming this last committee requires the council to pass an ordinance to allow for a committee of the whole. Right now, city code doesn't allow for a committee to be that large, but the advisors on the government transition recommended that the council allow for it. Many other cities similar to Portland do that. If passed, the new Finance and Governance Committee would include every councilor as a member. It would be tasked with overseeing the city's finances and budget preparation, executive appointments, city council structure, and emergency responses, among other things. Portland City Council meets next on Wednesday, February 18th at 6 p.m., but they'll hear these proposals at their meeting on Thursday at 2 p.m. If councilors pass the new committees, they'll take effect on March 23rd.
Oregon is likely to see some relief for its snow drought this week. Mount Hood could get 2 feet of snow this week between Monday and Wednesday. There's a slight chance of rain, snow mix in Portland area, but forecasters say it probably won't stick. The National Weather Service issued a winter weather advisory for parts of the Oregon Coast Range and the Cascade Range. 2 to 6 inches are expected tonight, with another foot possible later in the week. If that happens, that will double the snowpack on Oregon's mountains right now, which is good news, but it's likely still too little too late. If the rest of the season saw best-case scenario snowfall, officials say, the snow drought up to this point is too big to overcome. Later in the year, Oregon will be feeling that lack of snowpack, which feeds rivers through the hotter months. Less snowpack means potential drought conditions, and drier conditions during the wildfire season means those fires can't burn much hotter, quicker, and more intensely. As for next week, officials advise bringing chains if you're traveling in the mountains, and to keep an eye on the conditions as they change.
Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's chief strategist for the beginning of his first term, also extensively advised Jeffrey Epstein. The 3 million pages of Epstein-related documents released by the Justice Department in January reveal the extent of their relationship. In late June of 2019, Bannon sent Epstein an excited series of texts saying, quote, "Dude, is this real? Tell me this is real," end quote. That was in response to a message from Epstein saying his sexual abuse victims had lost a court battle to nullify an agreement that protected him from prosecution for those crimes. Bannon had been advising Epstein on how to handle allegations that he was a serial pedophile, including recommending which lawyers to hire, his own. He also scheduled what the two men called media training. Bannon wrote to Epstein saying, quote, "First, we need to push back on the lies, then crush the pedo trafficking narrative, then rebuild your image as philanthropist," end quote. In the 6 months before Epstein was arrested and charged with the sex trafficking of minors, Bannon's name appears nearly every day in the files. He is one of the biggest political names to be caught in the Epstein scandal. Bannon is a headline speaker at major Republican political events and hosts one of the nation's top political podcasts. Like many other prominent members of the MAGA movement, he had called for the release of the files. Bannon told the New York Times his relationship with Epstein was strictly professional. He says he was making a documentary about Epstein and never stayed over at any of Epstein's houses. Records released show that isn't true. He stayed over in Paris and met Epstein for more than a dozen meals at Epstein's home in Manhattan.
Two federal election bills, including the SAVE Act that passed in the U.S. House last week, are drawing strong criticism from Washington's voting rights organizations. The legislation would require all voters to have a passport or birth certificate that matches their current name, which could leave millions of Washington residents without a vote. Isabel Charlet reports.
Voting rights advocates in Washington are sounding the alarm about two bills in Congress they say would disenfranchise millions of voters in the state. The Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or SAVE America Act, passed in the U.S. House last week, and a broader package known as the Make Elections Great Again, or MEGA Act, has been introduced. Tony Ivey of Washington Conservation Action warns the SAVE Act would require a passport or birth certificate matching a voter's current name in order to register. Documents millions simply don't have. He says this requirement would block these eligible voters from the ballot box.
1.5 million women in the state of Washington have a name that does not match their birth certificate. 2.7 million Washingtonians do not have a passport. It puts our vote by mail system completely in a mess. Automatic voter registration is no longer going to be possible.
House Republicans say the legislation is necessary to quell the tide of non-citizens voting, but research shows that actual instances of non-citizen voting amount to a fraction of a percent of all votes, and most are mistakes that are quickly corrected. The SAVE Act is on its way to the U.S. Senate, where it is unlikely to pass. Democratic leader Chuck Schumer has said the bill would impose Jim Crow-type laws and calls it dead on arrival. But Doug Lindner with the League of Conservation Voters says even though the bill is unlikely to make it to President Donald Trump's desk, it is still important to see it in the context of a broader effort.
MAGA Republicans in all three branches of government are trying to roll back democracy and take away our right to choose our own leaders, because they know that their agenda is unpopular.
Ivy says, along with women, the law would disproportionately affect people who are elderly or have disabilities, as well as low-income and rural Washington residents by restricting mail-in ballots.
This is devastating for rural voters who are going to have to be traveling hours in order to be able to just simply register to vote or update their voter registration.
He says Washington's current voter registration systems, including through Medicaid enrollment and the DMV, are efficient and secure. He emphasizes state and county officials already have all the information they need to verify who is able to cast a ballot and who is not. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Court challenges start over the EPA's move to roll back the climate endangerment finding. Congress advances a proof of citizenship voting bill, and a Texas man sues a California doctor over providing abortion medicine. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This obviously is going to be litigated. It's important to understand that this action will have real-world consequences. What will happen is greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles will go up.
Philip Duffy is a former White House science advisor, now with Spark Climate Solutions. He says last week's White House repeal of the EPA's endangerment finding ignores proven science. The 2009 finding concluded greenhouse gases endanger public health and gave the federal government authority to regulate emissions from vehicles and power plants. Environmental groups say they'll base legal challenges to the deregulation in part on the increasingly visible long-term health and economic costs from pollution and extreme weather. The administration argues the Clean Air Act doesn't authorize climate regulations and says deregulation restores proper limits on federal authority. New Mexico is now the ninth state to blunt federal authority by ending participation in immigration detention. The just-signed Immigration Safety Act bans local governments from contracting with ICE and limits use of public resources for the enforcement. Carla Law with the ACLU of New Mexico says it'll build trust and make people more likely to cooperate with police.
We're really ensuring public safety is higher than ever amongst our most vulnerable communities and that they feel safe enough to approach local law enforcement without fear of them acting as deportation agents.
In Texas, a lawsuit is using a state law to try to influence another state's handling of abortion medication. House Bill 7 lets private citizens sue doctors and drug makers if abortion-inducing pills are distributed into Texas. A Galveston man is suing a California doctor for helping his partner get the drugs. Republican State Senator Brian Hughes supports the approach.
If you're going to manufacture these drugs and inject them in the stream of commerce and point them at Texas, you're going to be held accountable.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in Depth. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a daytime high of 45. Today in history, in 1945, the Alaska Equal Rights Act was signed into law. It was the first anti-discrimination law in the United States, and it was passed after Alaska Natives fought against segregation and other forms of discrimination in the state. The quote of the day is from author Anthony D. Williams, who said, quote, "Some of the greatest minds on earth live in the seas."
Native tribes are being urged by the federal government to lease their land to build data centers or to sell power for them. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The federal government is encouraging tribes to partner with data centers. That could mean leasing land or, as the Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach reports, selling power.
At a U.S. Department of Energy webinar, Ken Ahman with Colusa Indian Energy said that's where the big bucks come in.
Potentially billions of dollars into the coffers of tribes.
His company provides energy infrastructure to data centers on tribal land. He says these partnerships can be good for tribes that have land and resources to power big projects, like the Osage Nation in Oklahoma. Paul Beemore is the chair of the tribe's utility board.
Tribes that are casino dependent really need to look at other ways to build their economies, and I think that data centers is one of those opportunities.
Though Beemore says people may be wary about how this will impact the environment. Other tribes have expressed concerns about data centers draining precious water supplies. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
Disney's animated film Moana 2 has been translated into Hawaiian, just like the first movie. Hawaii Public Radio's Cassie Ordonio reports.
Most Disney productions are dubbed in more than 40 languages after appearing in English. The Moana series is one of them. The sequel made history with a global debut on Disney Plus this month, marking the beginning of Mihina Olelo Hawaii, or Hawaiian Language Month. Laiana Kanoa Wong is a member of the Moana 2 Oceanic Cultural Trust.
Things that you could find on the media or in shows, we didn't have it. We were watching every cartoon you could imagine at the time. We were watching all of these things, but nothing ever looked and sounded like us. And so being able to be a part of this project was a huge honor and privilege.
Kanoa Wong was honored to be a part of the project and to see the characters brought to life in Olelo Hawaii.
it was important to make sure that the Maoli Hawaii was still strong. Like the essence and what we were trying to say was still strong. Even if sometimes it didn't match perfectly with the lip flap, we forgave ourselves sometimes if it conveyed the meaning and it was helpful for that purpose. Sometimes like we would have written it out and we're like, oh, we got to add a few more things. Well, why don't we add this word or these sounds that can also deepen the meaning, but from a Hawaiian worldview.
Moana 2 tells the story of the Polynesian princess receiving a call from her wayfinding ancestors. She embarks on a dangerous journey across the ocean. She reunites with Maui and recruits other characters from her home in Motunui to join her. The Hawaiian language version of the film is produced by an all-local cast, including the original Moana voice actress Auli'i Kruvalho. The character Loto is voiced by Native Hawaiian actress Pualelea Panaeva.
For me, it was a very special opportunity to be able to voice a character in such a beloved Disney film series. Moana is huge, not just amongst like our people too, like not just amongst Hawaiians or Polynesians or Oceania, like in the world.
For National Native News, I'm Cassie Ordonio.
Jim Gray, former principal chief of the Osage Nation, is being remembered for his leadership and advocacy for Indian Country. He passed away last week at age 64. Chairperson Ben Barnes of the United Indian Nations of Oklahoma says Gray's achievements for his tribe and Indian Country have left a profound impact, including modernizing the Osage Nation's government by ratifying its first constitution and securing equal voting rights for every Osage member. The National Congress of American Indians President Mark McCarroll says Gray devoted his life to strengthening the Osage Nation and advancing tribal sovereignty. Funeral services are being held on Monday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Transgender rights advocates are pushing back on recent immigration enforcement measure in Arizona. They say transgender people face the same discrimination as migrants, some of whom have been deported or suffered abuse. Mark Morn has the story.
Arizona transgender rights advocates are pushing back on immigration enforcement tactics being employed in the state and across the country. They say trans people face many of the same discriminatory practices that immigrants face and have for decades. Issa Noyola, director of the Border Butterflies Project for the Transgender Law Center, says trans immigrants seeking asylum face an especially difficult challenge in the current political climate, and that immigrant and transgender rights abuses intersect.
Our work is in supporting folks to find safety in the system and safety during the process and getting folks stabilized with housing, getting folks stabilized in getting support services on the ground with other organizations, looping them with other services that exist.
Through a series of executive orders, Noyola says the Trump administration has adopted a whole-of-government approach that has restricted the rights of transgender and other marginalized people, calling it a common-sense agenda. The Border Butterflies Project is a coordinated response for transgender people at the southern border who are seeking asylum and facing obstacles. Noyola says it's been difficult even for immigrant rights groups to understand the challenges they face, including violence and exploitation.
So much of our work was to kind of get them to see sort of the ways that they can be more intentional in supporting trans immigrants and queer immigrants in their immigration work.
The Border Butterflies Project also focuses on leadership development, community organizing, and working to change laws that target the LGBTQ community. I'm Mark Moran for Arizona News Connection.
A congressional report shows tariffs imposed on essential baby safety products have cost American families on average an additional $400 in the past year. One nonprofit in Massachusetts says requests for strollers, cribs, and car seats have jumped significantly, but donations are on the decline. Catherine Carley tells us more.
Some Massachusetts families are struggling to pay the high cost of tariffs imposed on essential and often legally required baby products. Price data show items like strollers, cribs, and car seats have jumped nearly 25% since the Trump administration imposed new fees on Chinese manufactured goods last spring. Kenzie Kinsella with the Western Mass nonprofit It Takes a Village says more parents are asking for help, but donations are on the decline.
Our wait list right now for a proper 5
point harness car seat, I mean, we have 10 or 11 families waiting, and that's with us trying, you know, our very best to make connections.
She says requests for baby formula, diapers, and even children's winter gear have also increased. The Trump administration says higher tariffs on Chinese-made goods are needed for national security and that it will consider exemptions for baby products. It Takes a Village serves the four counties of western Massachusetts, but families often drive from out of state seeking help. What began as a small donation project out of a Huntington basement in 2009 has grown into a 6,000-square-foot facility, offering workforce training, parenting skills classes, a community food cupboard, and more. Kinsella says they recently changed their hours to better support the many working parents who struggle to make ends meet.
Families are working so hard to support their children. So having a place to turn to, like the Village Closet, where there is no judgment, that they can come and we can try our very best to support them in what they are looking for, can be a huge weight off their shoulders.
She says more than 70 volunteers hand sort all donations to ensure items are in good condition and that it isn't uncommon for up to 200 individuals to shop during open hours. She notes transportation can be a barrier for many families to get to the center and says volunteers will deliver items to families when needed. More than 500 deliveries were made last year. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
An Oregon expert says this year's tax code changes are especially complicated, and AARP's Foundation Tax Aid program is available to help taxpayers wade through them. The program offers free expert help to file income tax returns with a focus on low and moderate income older adults through April 15th. Isabel Charlet reports.
It's officially income tax season, and Oregonians have access to free expert assistance through the AARP Foundation Tax Aid Program through April 15th. The program offers tax preparation and filing services for anyone, with a focus on low and middle-income older adults. Kathy Gettle has been a volunteer tax preparer with the program for 42 years. She says keeping up with new tax codes every year can be overwhelming for people on their own, and that the changes coming out of D.C. can make it especially complicated.
We go through training and we do many, many, many returns. So we're pretty fast. We also double check everything. So you get a very high quality return done and it's all for free.
Gettle says last year, tax aid volunteers helped more than 19,000 Oregonians file their tax returns, securing $16 million in refunds. She says taxpayers can choose in-person preparation, drop-off service, or get help online. People can look online at aarpfoundation.org/taxaid to book an appointment. Gettle says all of Oregon's roughly 500 tax aid volunteers are IRS certified each year to stay on top of the latest tax code changes. This year, that includes a new senior bonus deduction of up to $6,000 for individuals 65 and older, or $12,000 for those filing jointly. She says the annual training requires hours of study, but in the end, it's worth it.
During the pre-work, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this, but you get back at it and you forget all about how much work it was and just enjoy who you're with and working with your team.
TaxAid is the country's largest free volunteer-based tax filing program. Last year, nationwide, over 28,000 volunteers helped people get more than $1.3 billion in refunds and tax credits. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
In some parts of the U.S., frozen lakes present a host of winter fun opportunities. But winter ice isn't always what it used to be. Warmer winters can result in thinner ice, so knowing safety rules is essential. Dr. Anthony Leiswitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leiswitz, and this is Climate Connections. Each winter, people in northern areas eagerly wait for lakes to freeze so they can go ice fishing or ice skating. But as the climate changes, winters are getting warmer, and in many areas, lakes are freezing later in the fall and melting earlier in the spring. Warmer weather also makes ice weaker and more likely to break. So if you're heading out onto a frozen lake, it's important to take precautions. Bring safety gear like a life vest, ice pick, and rope, and pack a tape measure you can use to check the ice's thickness. It should be at least 4 inches thick to walk on and much thicker to drive onto. And remember, these guidelines only apply to clear ice, which forms as lake water freezes. White ice, which forms from ice or snow that is thawed and then refrozen, is weaker and needs to be much thicker to be safe. If ice does start cracking beneath you, lie down to spread your weight and roll away. And if you fall in, use an ice pick to grab firm ice, kick to pull yourself up, and go warm up immediately. No ice is completely safe, and as the climate warms, the risks will grow. But if you're careful, you can still enjoy a winter day skating or ice fishing.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 16th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Jacob Earl. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Moran, Catherine Carley, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO on Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.